So the title of the talk is Living Life as a Vegan with Joy and Health and Kindness. And the purpose why this talk, why this meeting, is actually to understand how we can take our vegan or vegetarian choices as simply the starting point and not the end point. And the starting point to actually enrich the experience of what it means to be a vegan or a vegetarian and to pay attention to our diet in that way, actually to take it further, solve some problems and go deeper into that whole story. And I want to start with three personal stories. The first is, I have chickens, and I enjoy them. They are my friends. And when people ask me, well, I suppose you, when they stop laying eggs, you eat them. And I say, no, would you eat your friends? And I kind of talk to each one of them, and they each have a character, and they're like my friends, these chickens, and they give eggs, and I eat them. I'm not a vegan, but I'm a vegetarian. And I remember one day, I was really the beginning of my teaching in Israel. I was doing a weekend in a moshav outside Jerusalem, and it was right next to an industrial chicken shed, Lul Tanigolot, with like 10,000 chickens, and the house I was teaching this weekend was right next to the Lul. And I kept finding myself in tears in the middle of meditation instructions or whatever. I suddenly found myself crying, and people said, what's the matter? Something happened to you? Something happened to you? And I didn't answer until sort of the end of the weekend. But what was happening was, I was listening to the cries of 10,000 frustrated, miserable, unhealthy, suffering chickens. And I just listened to them, their calls and their cries, and it touched me, and it made me cry. And so I'm kind of very affected by this, but how I became a vegetarian is rather different. I was in India in 1975, and I was teaching at university there in Varanasi. And a yogi on the banks of the river Ganga, the Ganges River, and there are plenty of yogis there, and he sat down with me one day and began to explain to me the Indian concept of sattva. Now, sattva is, there's in the Indian sort of philosophy of life, there's three gunas, qualities: sattva, rajas, and tamas. And tamas is like negative energy, it's also low energy, it's also tiredness, it's also weakness, it's also bloated, it's also stuck. And rajas is the Western way of life. It's energetic, it's running, it's agitated, it's speedy, it's hormones, it's testosterone, it's like the like Tel Aviv. And sattva is the not just the middle ground, but the quality of refined awareness, of subtle awareness, of harmony in life, of clarity, inner peace. And what was interesting is that all things that you do move you in one of those directions, and the food you eat will move you in one of those directions. So in other words, your diet can be sattvic, and sattvic diet means a diet that helps to create non-violence in your constitution. The food affects the mind and affects the soul, along with everything else. So there's a real holistic picture of, if you go towards a sattvic way of life, you go towards harmony, non-harming, inner peace, relationship, and not energetically speedy or tired. Energy is right. Life is right. It's a kind of a holistic concept called sattva, very important in Indian philosophy and Indian life. And food is part of this. And I realized, well, I have to be vegetarian because it affects the mind. And the mind, body, and life, the whole of life. And that was where it started for me. So, and it's been like that ever since. And so what I want to do in this talk is partly bring that bigger vision of sattva, if you like, into the discussion inside us and inside your house or your family or your life, to make this thing more rich, the decision what to eat, and not just minimal issue, but rather interesting, big issue. And the third little story, also from that time in India in 1975-76, there was I was living on my own, I was cooking for myself, and I was going cycling into the university every day, and there was a knock on the door, and a young boy was standing there saying, "You need a cook." I said, "I don't need a cook, I'm fine, thank you very much. I'm cooking for myself, I don't need it." The boy said, "No, you don't understand. You are part of a community, and you're taking from the community, you have to give to the community. If you employ a cook, you are supporting two families. And that's your contribution to the community you live in Varanasi." And I said, "If you say it like that, I have no choice." Of course. But it was an incredible experience. The mother of this boy came to cook for me every day. And I began to, and through interpreters, from Hindi to English, I began to understand that she was cooking from a deep ancient cultural knowledge in which she designed the food of the day according to the constitution, the mivne guf, the constitution of the person who's eating it, whether they're big, heavy, light, oily, thin, whatever, any health problems that this person has at that time, too much mucus, headaches, tummy, anything, the weather and the season, what was fresh in the market at that time, the combinations that fit together of vegetables and spices, the colors and the taste, and ease of digestion and absorption and nutritional balance. And all of those factors taken intuitively into the creation of one dish, which was the dish of the day. And that huge knowledge, if you think about that, and that was cultural. It's not something that she had to learn in books. She learned it from her mother. And if you think of that knowledge and that richness compared to today, we go into the supermarket and say, "I feel like pasta, or I feel like, or I feel like, some Tivol or some product. What do I feel like? Ma bali, ayom." Then there's such a different. So the richness of this is huge, and that's another story that I want to express here. So first of all, I want to discuss a little bit some of the problematic aspects of being a vegan. Some of the difficulties, and some of them you've mentioned already here in this circle. And I just want to relate to some of the difficult issues and then begin to look at how the Dharma would address these issues. First issue, which, Toma, you addressed, I think, is we have to be careful that something that we do and we believe is right doesn't become a new orthodoxy. So it can turn into a mitzvah, like to be dati, to be religious about, "I'm a vegan and other people should be vegans too," and this is become an orthodox issue, and then you put pressure onto people around you who are not doing what you believe. And however beautiful and precious it is. And it is precious and beautiful to do this. It's not that I'm in any way against. I'm 100% for it. However, I'm also have to be, from especially from the Dharma point of view, be careful not to create an orthodoxy. And that's one of the problems. It can be conformist, a certain new conformism. And I must say, I tell another small story. This is from another period of mine, another year I spent in India in the 90s. And I was teaching in a school in India, and it was Krishnamurti school. And there was a gathering based on the Krishnamurti teaching. There was a gathering from people all over India to for a few days to discuss the issue of non-violence. And so there were groups and talks and meditations and so on and so on. And I was in a group, and we were discussing non-violence. And there was an Indian, real Hindu yogi there in Patanjali tradition. And he said, I believe totally in non-violence, ahimsa, it's called. I haven't hurt a fly or a mosquito in the last 25 years. I don't harm anybody. And this is so much part of my belief and my culture that this whole discussion is not relevant to me, because I'm totally in this world of ahimsa. And there was a young boy, because this was a school, there was a young boy, must have been 15, 16, and he said, I want to say something. And they said, yes. Your conformism is violent. Just what you said. Your conformism is violent. I conform you. And it was a total shock. And the guy had tears in his eyes, the old yogi, and he said, you know what? You're right. Mm-hmm. And it was a beautiful moment. I've never forgotten it. But we have to be careful that our views, if we hold them too strongly, end up being rather violent in a subtle way, but still violent, just like any orthodoxy ends up being in some way violent, or at least aggressive. So that's one aspect. I would say, to balance that a bit, that at times it is important to be go all the way with something, and not to be half-hearted and to be wobbly. So in a way, especially if you're doing social change, you do need to go all the way and to be very, you know, you need to be very decisive sometimes and say, this is what I'm doing, and very clear, and so on. So it is sometimes needed, if you're making, in a way, social change, to have a very, you know, real clarity around it and not to wobble and say, I'm going all the way with this. But there is a space between that and orthodoxy. So even though it's very decisive and you can express it everywhere to whoever you want, there's a way to do it without imposing principles on others. And so that's one problem I see which can be problematic. Another problem, which is none of you really brought up here, but I've met it in quite a few places before, is something in a psychological pattern where we take pain that we experience in the world and sort of apply it inside to ourselves. In other words, we hurt ourselves because of the pain in the world, or the pain that we experience around us. And it's like a child that sort of says to a parent, okay, you were like that, so I'm not going to have supper. Like taking the pain inside, and in an extreme case of sort of the emotional life of teenagers and so on, it can go to anorexia anorexia being, for example, the reaction to the pain around or to hardness or not missing love or other reasons, but hurting oneself in a way. And it can go to asceticism, sakfanut, and it can go to denial. So I'm, as a response to the pain in the world, I will deny myself. And just to be aware of that, that side of things, it's the, it says, I have to suffer because of the suffering that I see around. And that's a psychological movement which is there in food issues. And like I say, it can go from anorexia to people taking on very extreme diets, almost like, because of the world around, because of, I told you so. What did you call it? Cherev pipiot. Cherev pipiot. And a third issue that I want to raise, or problem that I want to raise, is that it can often be associated with some, with just not knowing enough. That it's more what you don't have than what you do have. So it's kind of it can get to be quite limited. So you say, for example, I'm a vegan, but you don't notice that you're eating processed food from the supermarket, bambas and tivols and packaged food and industrial food. It's all vegan, but it's industrial food, and you're supporting exactly the same set, mindset and conceptual world that can keep 10,000 miserable chickens in one industrial chicken shed. And it's the same mindset of industrial processing of life. And so when you eat processed packaged food, etc., it's not a good answer to being a vegan. So that's it's a problem of limited vision. And when you think of the story I told you about the mother of the boy, Lakshman Kamai, the mother of Lakshman, and how her knowledge, then you see how much knowledge and wisdom can be applied. And Isaac, you brought it up before. And how much knowledge can be applied. And so a problem with the vegan thing is, okay, I won't have this, I won't have this, I won't have this, and you end up a very minimal life. And there is a lack of wisdom there. And it can also create health problems, of course, just by minimalizing by what not, rather than what yes, what no. No this, no this, no this. So what's left? Boring white rice. And I've been to houses where people have been vegan, and I've had lunch there, and they've been white rice and potatoes. And I've been a little bit cautious, because I'm not aggressive to people and saying, you know, someone who, I don't sort of offer, sort of come heavy with advice and so on when I'm not asked for it. I need a permission in a way from people, then I can offer something. So I didn't say anything, but I was a bit sad to see, you know, how the ignorance there was, and it leads to inadequate health as well. Then you need B12 injections and iron and this and that, because you don't understand the richness of the possibility of a rich, completely healthy diet which is vegan, which today we've got so much possibility out there. The supermarket is full of food. We can, with no reason, you can say maybe it's Tibetans who come from a culture that has pretty well no vegetables, and they live on goat herding and yaks and so on in Tibet, in the high plateaus of Tibet, and they don't have anything except animal products. So you could say, well, there's a reason for them to eat meat, because there isn't anything else. But there isn't a reason for the Tibetans in India to still eat meat. And there isn't a reason for us to eat meat with the supermarkets packed with endless choices. So we need the wisdom to avoid being very limited and unhealthy. And this is not the time when I can begin to sort of talk about that whole actually what to eat. And I did issue it's up in the notice board. I did send around 10 guidelines on being healthy as a vegan. I wrote it and sent it around. So it's around. I mean, okay, you'll get it. But again, it needs research and looking at it and learning and so on. It's not just something in 1 minute that you can give this advice. But it's good to read about it. And there's no reason whatsoever that that vegan diet needs to be in any way unhealthy. And you can run marathons on it. In fact, I read scientific stuff that says people that don't eat meat, but vegetarians actually often do better at marathons because something in the body is learned to be efficient with what is, rather than having to have loads and loads of, you know, all these super supplements that you buy in the shops for building muscles and so on. Instead of that, the body knows how to live with less. And there's been quite a lot of research on vegetarian and vegan diets and health. So there one more thing that I want to raise before discussing some kind of answers. And one very crucial thing around the issue of ethics. And this is, we need to kind of look more deeply at what is ethics, especially in the Buddhist world, and what it means, ethics. And I'll give you the example of the Buddha, because the Buddha wasn't a vegetarian. So everyone gets surprised. Well, the Buddha wasn't a vegetarian? No, the Buddha ate meat, and so did his monks. So your first... Yes. The Buddha ate meat, and so did his monks. And so your first reaction would be, how is it possible that the Buddha ate meat? But then when you look at it more carefully, you realize it makes sense. So clearly. First of all, and this is this gives you an indication of the big view of ethics, this story. First of all, he would never, ever, and it was crucial, no animal should be killed in order to feed me or any of the monks. So what the Buddha and the monks were, was collectors of waste. They ate the leftover food of the villagers. Whatever the villagers had leftovers from their meal, they would give to the monks. The monks would knock on the door and bring a bowl, and in that bowl, until today, the Theravada monks do exactly the same, in their bowl, they would receive whatever was given to them, whether it's meat or not meat. But the only thing is, the villagers, part of the culture, has to know whether it's even the king of the local community, no animal must be killed because of the Buddha or the monks. So they were really taking the waste and living off the extra that people didn't need, that they threw out. And they did that with everything. Not only food, but also their robes. The original Buddhists made their robes out of rags and rejected pieces of cloth, and they sewed robes from thrown out cloth. And they had no house, and they had no car that ate petrol and polluted the atmosphere, and they had no houses that where you need electricity, fridges, money. They didn't fly planes. In other words, their whole life was so minimal profile and so careful about not using up resources, and they were so careful about not killing even an insect, that the stories of the monks, when they would throw out some waste, they would look very carefully where they threw it to make sure there wasn't even a small insect under what they threw that would die because they threw out something. They would make sure that where they walked, they weren't stepping on one ant or one insect. You see how they, so therefore their life was, if you like, ultimately ecological. And if we look at it like this, we also understand that we ourselves, we may be vegan, but we can't help destroying just by our existence. I mean, I live in Clill, and Clill is an ecological village. And I built my house trying to be as ecological as possible, using stones from the earth, growing my own food, and keeping chickens, trying to a minimal profile to harm as little as possible the environment through building a house and living. But it was so clear that that's impossible. Just to put a house in the middle of nature, you take the habitat away from animals, so the animals can't be there where you are, and you use water, and you use resources just by existing. Just by driving a car, just by everything you do, you're using up resources, and you're polluting. We have solar energy. We don't have electricity from the Greshet, from the grid where we live. But someone made solar panels, needs energy to make them, huge amount of waste and factories and so on to make solar panels. You, whatever you do, you're harming. So the Buddha, in a sense, was saying, take ethics as a total thing, and the way we do it as the most sort of authentic teachers of ethics is minimum profile. We'll live under the trees and we'll eat leftovers. And we will not pollute and we will not kill an insect and we will not use up the world. So you can see that now the thing looks very different from what the Buddha isn't of it was eating meat. Now we can see how actually it's a much bigger picture. And one of the reasons that the Buddha didn't was very important. He died because he, at the age of 80, someone gave him meat, which he knew was going to contaminate it, and he knew he would die from it. And he still ate it. And he said, it's more important for me just to accept what is. At this time in my life, that's fine. He said, that's more or less what he said. And so one of the issues underneath all the ethics is the Buddha and the Buddhist monks are very interested, and Buddhist practitioners, including us here in this room, are very interested in reducing our desires, our neediness, our pressure, our aversions, what we want, what we don't want, what we need, what we don't need, what we like, what we don't like, and reducing all of that control on us. And that was why, for the monks, it was very important just to have no choice. Whatever goes into the bowl is good enough. And it's a bit like, as Ajahn Amaro said once, it's just like the bowl is like my mind. Whatever goes in my mind is good enough. So whatever goes in my bowl is good enough. I won't select, I won't choose this, and I want that, and I want this experience, and I want that thing, and I need a new this, and I need a special that, and I need to go shopping for this, and I need. Wait. Just breathe and see whatever arises is good enough. That movement is the basis of ethics. Because with that movement, you're not putting pressure on others and on life to conform to your needs. You're not manipulating or expecting life to provide you with what you think you want all the time. And therefore, you're not putting pressure on other people to provide you. You're not deciding what other people are. For example, conflict is because you label somebody else as disturbing or threatening. That's a mental decision. That person's making me uncomfortable. The Palestinians there are making us uncomfortable, and they are, we define them as threat, and therefore we sustain 100 years of conflict, which is totally madness. But it's because of a movement in the mind, which is continuing generation after generation, that identifies them as the problem, disturbing my peace and well-being, creating fear and insecurity inside, and so much damage and suffering coming from that. So much damage, hurt, pain, suffering that this will last 100 years and nobody can stop it, because it's in the mind. So the basis of ethics has to be a sense of being clear and being letting go from the neediness of trying to kind of sort out life according to what I think I want and what my emotions are and what my fears are and what my needs are and what my interests are, and projecting that onto life creates ethical issues. So the root of ethics has to be inside, and that's very key issue in the Buddhist world. The root of ethics is not outside how you behave, but the source of your behavior is inside, how you deal with your inner life. And your fears and neediness is just an example of that. So I want to kind of look at some ways where which we can expand the whole issue of being a vegan. And one way we can look at this, which is kind of really helpful and very much in the Dharma, is that we look at being a vegan as an experience and not as a principle. So what is the experience of this way of life? How I experience it intimately? What is it that I... what's my relationship with this food that I'm eating, for example? How I feel as an experience ethically from changing my diet. What does it do to me ethically? What is the ethics that I'm trying to live by? So immediately you ask that question as an experience and not a kind of a principle that you take on an orthodoxy, but an experience, an ethical experience. It opens a huge world. It opens the world of relationships. You can begin to actually see what is your relationship to food, to animals. So therefore, okay, you don't eat industrial animals, but what about your relationship when you walk down the street with animals? How are you when you hear a cat crying? Do you step on insects? If you pay attention to it as experience, it opens many, many doors. We live in a community. You could say the biosphere is a community. We are in interrelationship. All beings are one sangha, are one community. Every insect, every animal, every dog, every cat, every human being, every child, every adult is in interrelationship all the time. We are all interconnecting with each other. There's one giant community. How are we with this community? That we share the same home of this space. We live together. So that asks us to be mindful. And here's where practice comes in. Be mindful of how we are with animal life, with ourselves, with our diet, with what the way we are with our vegan, how it affects others and how it affects ourselves. Open the whole experience to open a world of relationships that the vegetarian or vegan aspect is one aspect called, that's the way I choose to live, but it's just the beginning. If it's an experience. By experiencing our relationship with the animal world, our diet, our bodies that are digesting this food, how we live, we get more and more sensitive. So if we open the experience, it makes us sensitive and aware. We, as an experiencer, so we experience what the food does to our bodies. We experience how we are when we go into the supermarket. We experience how we are with others who don't eat, who eat meat. We experience pain and suffering of animals. Not just a principle, I don't eat animals, but actually experiencing, that was my first story, I mean when I was crying because of the chickens, experiencing the whole world of relationships opens a big ethical door, which the vegan direction can open the door, but we need to go through it, the door, and explore our interrelationships every time we eat something. And then when we explore the relationship, we will not maybe decide, okay, I'm a vegan, but I will not have Tivol. Why? Because they use this and they use this and they put chemicals inside and how are their workers treated in the factory? I don't know. I will not have Bamba and this and this because of the way they take nature and process it and process it and process it and then take money from us for destroying food. Which is basically what happens. Just take a good, even cornflakes is just based on tiras, so take tiras. As soon as you have cornflakes in a packet, you have a whole industry that has to be paid for, that takes something very, very natural and simple and destroys it. And then you have to add vitamins, by the way, back to the, because you've taken them all out by processing them, so you add chemical vitamins. The whole thing is, so you explore that and it becomes intimacy. And I think that here is the message, a very, sort of take-home message that I'd like to express, that ethics is based on intimacy. And intimacy is 24 hours. How am I with what goes into my mouth? How am I with the joy of cooking natural foods? Instead of saying, no, 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 I'm going to have a good time playing with the tastes and with the nutrition, just like the Indian story of the Indian mother. I'm going to explore different ways of cooking so that things work out better. I'm going to spend a bit of time in the kitchen in touch with what goes into my mouth. Not just to sort of say, I won't have that, then I'll just stuff in some whatever is around and I won't pay attention to what goes into my mouth or what goes into my life. So it's an invitation, the bigger view of intimacy can start with this simple principle, I don't want to eat animals, but that's just the beginning. And it goes on from there to interrelationship with the different worlds that we live in, the animal world, the people world, the different worlds, and the self, and how we live, and what is important for us, and what we support. We support the industry that makes those animals suffer, or do we not? And I think that, from there, then there is joy. One of the places that we can look for joy is in this sense of discovery, of opening what was closed. relationship, good relationship, harmonious relationship, which is in that word sattva, the Indian word, the Sanskrit word that I mentioned at the beginning. Harmonious relationship. Sattva brings joy. Sattva brings peace. The harmonious relationship we have with the world, that's where we find our joy. We find our joy by being intimate with others, with the food, with the relationships, with non-harming. If we don't harm others, we feel joy inside. We feel more pure. We feel more, no regrets, and no, we don't do damage in the world, or less damage. It makes us more joyful. And then add to that the discovery of what it means to be in relationship with what goes in our mouth and what we do, and that's a journey, and that's a learning, and there's a lot of joy in that. My wife, Rachel, she's a great cook, and she used to teach vegetarian cooking at the Akko College. I used to teach also Western Galilee College in Akko. So she used to teach natural cooking at the college, and I used to teach holistic medicine, because that was my previous career or profession. And she would begin bringing huge baskets of leaves and vegetables and roots and herbs, you know, baskets and baskets, and just have them there on the table. And invite everybody just to be quiet and look and see what's in front of them. And there's a celery leaf, and there's a beetroot, and there is a few nuts, and there is, you know, and there is red colors of a pepper, and there's this, and there's that. And just experiencing it visually. And then the cooking, touching, cutting, how things go together, the movements, then the colors, then the, and then all the time stories. She would tell stories in between of especially in relation to Jewish mysticism, which is her world. And then they would be eating of it. And the whole thing was like 3 hours of extraordinary interest and richness and so on, based on cooking one meal.
And eating it together.
And she's still in that world, and I used to cook Indian food a lot at home. I don't do that so much because Rachel so loves to cook every day, so I don't have any place. I'm just doing the washing up, but doesn't matter. I'm part of the story. The creativity there is huge. So there's a joy in that, and a well-being, ravacha. There's a well-being if you discover things, rather than having a principle of denying. What not doesn't really bring a lot of joy. But what is, and the discovery process, brings a lot of joy and harmony and relationship. So there is joy in this. And I want to introduce a Buddhist concept which is very similar to sattva, in the Sanskrit or the Indian concept. And the Buddhist concept is called kusala. Now, kusala is something that the Buddhist monks till today in Thailand and Cambodia and so on, they talk about it non-stop. Non-stop. Because they're very busy with how they are, with things. They're very busy with action in the monasteries, how to act right. They have a lot of principles and kind of monastic rules that they keep. But kusala is a kind of thread running. It's very similar to sattva, but it's a Buddhist concept. And it's the best translation into English of kusala, and why it's very relevant to this topic, is wholesome. Wholesome in English means nutrition, and it means harmony, and it means non-harming, and it means beneficial, And it's on the level of body and mind and on the level of spirit. So what is wholesome, for example, nutritional, on the level of spirit is, for example, meditation. Meditation is wholesome, nutritional, on the level of our inner life. So it's seen in a rather different way from meditation as a technique for opening doors and wisdom and liberation, but also meditation is a way of relating nutrition, feeding the soul, if you like, along, and so many other things too. Now the Buddhist teaching doesn't have a good and a bad. It doesn't have evil. There's no evil in the Buddhist teaching. The teaching doesn't go in that direction. That's a Western Christian, Judeo-Christian. The Buddhist language is different. It's what do you feed in the person? And what do you not feed? So feeding would be feeding the bigness of spirit, feeding ethical behavior. Spiritual practice is a feeding your freedom rather than feeding your sense of being on automatic pilot, just functioning in life and suffering. You feed the joy, you feed the peace, you feed liberation and inner freedom. And you don't feed attachments, difficult habits, unethical things. You just don't feed them. But you don't give yourself a hard time. So those people, there isn't blame. Blame is not encouraged in the Buddhist teaching because it's not nutritional. It's negative. So instead of, for example, blaming someone that eats meat, you would maybe feed that part of them that knows non-harming already because they're also a human being. So they already know something about peace and not harming. So you'd feed that side of them rather than blame them for eating meat. And those of you who have parents, your story, you know, who have close relations who eat meat and you want to, in a way, support that. So you encourage the goodness in their spirit with kindness, rather than blame that they're helping to kill cows. And it's what you feed. So it's very much in this world that we're talking about. It's very fitting. Kusala, akusala is what is not, akusala is what is not wholesome or harmonious or healthy or non-violent or ethically wise. And all the time, kusala, akusala, in every moment, every thought of ours, every word we speak, every action we do, can go in one direction. This kusala or akusala can be helpful, can reduce suffering in the world, or can be non-helpful, cause suffering, cause more difficulty, cause pain, cause more ignorance and closing ourselves, or opening, or wisdom. And every thought is kusala or akusala. It gets very, very subtle. So I just want to introduce that so much part of this whole dialogue. So, you know, that we have to be vegans from love. Feed the love, rather than be vegan through blame or anger against others that aren't vegan. Because kusala, it's helpful, love is helpful, and anger just goes into the world and makes more problems. So there's no point. We're actually making damage by being vegan and being angry with everyone who eats meat. Instead of that, we are going for harmony and kindness and wholesomeness. One small thing about health, that the research does show
that vegans are the more healthy than meat eaters all the way through. And most of the diseases that affect the modern world, which include heart disease, cancer, arthritic diseases, chronic diseases, and that's your department, Isaac, too. The chronic diseases that affect Western society are hugely, hugely less in vegans. But it's a huge difference, like dramatic difference. Vegetarians also, but less. But those vegans have a major, major reduction in their risk of getting these kinds of diseases that are the major killers of the Western world. So it's really, really clear. But I said heart disease, blood pressure, cancer,
cholesterol.
But cholesterol is a source of disease, not the disease, but they're basically blocked arteries.
Statistically?
Yes, lots of research on this.
Yeah, widening up population of people.
Yes, yes, yes. And but this research, I mean, I was involved in this in 1972, 73, and there was already research then. So there's been 40 years since then of research. So it's really there. It's well, very, very well established. Just to emphasize in one sentence, because I think I've said it before, but the vegan diet is fundamentally more healthy than any other diet, but you absolutely need the knowledge. The knowledge can be cultural, and I think that, you know, Iran, what you were saying before about it's in your environment to cook vegetables and so on and so on, that's part of our knowledge. We begin to collect knowledge from each other. So you say it's not a problem, you know, the food is around and you eat vegetables and it's rather natural for you because you've got an environment that's already supporting this. But quite a lot of people don't necessarily have that knowledge and they need to get it. For example, one of the most problematic things is oils. So you think oils, no problem.
Nuts.
But, well, the problem is purified oils. One of the most problematic things in health is shmanim, is oils that are industrial oils. Like you buy in the supermarket for cheap oil, which is processed and purified, don't touch it. It is not healthy to eat purified processed oils. And it's very cheap. So people think, well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with oil. I fry it. Okay. It won't kill you, but it if you ask what's one of the most problematic things in a diet is actually the quality of the oils that you go into your mouth. And it's something that you need to learn about and it needs some exploration. So that's more or less what I want to say. And to summarize, just let that, you know, the decision about being a vegan to be the beginning and not the end. To be the beginning of a doorway into a life of responsibility. Responsibility, I like the English word, responsibility. Ability to respond. The way we are with our life. To really use this as the doorway to begin to look at all the aspects of our life, how we are intimate with others, other beings that we share this home, planet with, this, and ourselves and the world around us, and the what we support, what we feed, both in our inner life and in our society, whether we support sort of industrial foods and if we support what we support. And it's a sense of mothering, actually. We can find ourselves being quite in a place where ethically we are mothering. We are like a mother. And that's a concept also from the Buddhist teaching, that we are like a mother to all beings, looking after and caring for all other beings through compassionate action. And we can feel that movement as a positive movement in our way of life, rather than the negative, I won't eat that. It's the positive that we're talking about there, the movement that enriches our life. And through this sense of intimacy, of being with others and humans and animals and ourselves and the world and the society, this sensitivity and awareness and mindfulness and heartfulness is the basis. Yeah, so that's, I think, what I want to say at this point. So let's just take one moment of quietness, and then we can have some questions and discussions.